This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It's almost a month since September 11th, and as American forces prepare for war, so does the nation. In the short term, Americans have grieved together. But as time passes, what will the range of American responses be? And what factors will shape those responses? Age? Life experience? Politics? It's not as simple as war or peace. This hour, we're exploring the full range and texture of America's response to a new challenge. First, more U.S. troops have been deployed today. For where and what it means, we turn to Charlie Olinger, Pentagon correspondent for Reuters. Good evening, Charlie.
How are you, Tom?
We're well, thanks. Charlie, where are the troops headed, and how many troops are we talking about?
Tom, about 1,000 troops from the United States' Light 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, New York, are headed for Uzbekistan.
And what are they being deployed to do?
Well, ostensibly they're being deployed to protect cargo planes and helicopters that are apparently going to be allowed to use one airbase there for search and rescue operations and possibly humanitarian missions. The Defense Secretary, General Rumsfeld, was in Tashkent today and held a press conference with the President of Uzbekistan, who said that that one base could be used for humanitarian operations and possibly search and rescue if military action was taken against Afghanistan, but that no offensive military action would be allowed.
Is that a disappointment or a setback for the U.S. not to
be
able to use
well,
that?
Well, Tom, the statement is rather vague, and when asked why he wasn't allowing U.S. special operations troops into the country, his reply was a cryptic, we're not ready for that yet. What that means, of course, there's a large gray area there, and it's not clear whether or not U.S. fighter jets would be allowed into Uzbekistan to protect such humanitarian missions and possibly search and rescue missions. And, of course, that could turn into offensive operations.
Does the Pentagon need Uzbekistan as a base for military operations as opposed to humanitarian to be successful in the mission they anticipate?
Well, there's differing opinions among analysts on that issue. Uzbekistan, of course, is a close neighbor right across the border from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it would make it a lot easier for the United States to conduct such operations. Having said that, there's also an aircraft carrier headed into the Indian Ocean, which could be used as a base on the southern side for special operations troops. And then there are other areas where they could be flown in, although this is much closer.
Mm-hmm. So what about the call-up of reservists and National Guard? What's the latest on that front?
Well, there have been about 27,000 Reserve and National Guard troops called to active duty so far. As you know, the President earlier authorized the Defense Department to call as many as 50,000 up. These would mostly be used for so-called homeland defense to protect the United States ports and to help staff airfields in the country, which are providing fighter cover. Some of them, of course, would be used to support these overseas operations, although it's not clear how many yet.
So, Charlie, with all these troop movements and equipment movements, what does the U.S. force deployment in the Afghan greater region around it look like now?
Well, it's quite large, Tom. There are bombers, B-52 bombers and B-1 bombers. We believe they're stationed on the British island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. They could fire long-range cruise missiles. There are many ships in the Indian Ocean and the Gulf area with cruise missiles that could be fired more than 1,000 miles. There are, of course, fighter jets throughout the Gulf area, which could be used for air cover. And their troops, although the Pentagon has been very quiet about the deployment of troops. In fact, a senior official traveling with the Defense Secretary in Uzbekistan today did confirm that the troops had been deployed from Fort Drum, New York. But other than that, there's been very little comment from the Pentagon about any deployment of troops.
But we've seen the number 30,000 as the total number of troops in the region?
Well, yes, Tom, but that 30,000 would include troops that are already in the region, have been in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and aboard aircraft carriers in the region, supporting the policing of the no-fly zone in southern Iraq.
Charlie, is it possible from what we know about troop and equipment deployments to speculate about what kind of military action the deployments to date suggest we might?
No, it's not, Tom. The Secretary has made very clear that there will not be any kind of D-Day, as he puts it, in this war on terrorism, that there will be small operations, and that some you might not even hear about or see.
But is this is a large deployment? Is it one that we can sustain over time?
Well, it's a very large deployment, Tom, but it's large in the sense that these troops will be looking at troops and weapons. We'll be looking at a lot of contingencies. You know, there's speculation that there might even be eventually attacks on countries such as Iraq and possibly guerrilla bases in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. But that's only the president and the administration have made clear that Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda organization are first on the list. And once that's taken care of, then the United States will turn to states that support terrorism and perhaps other terrorist groups. Mm-hmm.
Charlie Ellinger, thank you very much.
Yeah. Surely, Tom. Glad to help.
Charlie Ellinger is the Pentagon correspondent for Reuters. World War II, Vietnam, the Gulf War. Some Americans served in these wars, others protested them, and the youngest generation of Americans has just read about them in history books. How will this country, with such diversity of culture and life experience, respond to the war on terrorism? Listeners, how are you making sense of the events of September 11th? Are you looking through a generational lens to form your thoughts? What's the diversity of views around your kitchen table? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Historian Neil Howe is co-author of Millennials Rising, The Next Great Generation, and The Fourth Turning in American Prophecy. He joins us from Washington. Good evening, Mr. Howe.
Good evening, Tom.
And joining us from New York is Todd Gitlin, a professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University and the author of The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. Good evening, Professor Gitlin.
Hi there.
And also with us in the studio tonight is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Neil Howe, we saw unanimity in the very first response to the attacks on the United States. As the weeks go by, we see glimmers of a range emerging here. You've looked very closely at the generations that are at work and alive in the United States today, from seniors right down through the youngest, which you call millennials. How do you see the differences in generation and age playing into the national response to September 11 and the aftermath?
Well, I think you've seen some very interesting contrasts, starting from the old end and working our way to the younger end. We've seen the GI generation, certainly in the news. This is the generation that came of age during the Great Depression and World War II. I know many of us have seen Cap Weinberger and George Shultz, and I'm sure the president's own father has been advising him on policy. This is a generation that's giving their advice on, you know, what this kind of thing is like, keeping their heads screwed on well, keeping calm. This is probably a generation least surprised by what's going on in the sense of, you know, not knowing how we're supposed to feel about it.
Because they've seen major disruptions before.
Because they've gone through, everyone's comparing this to, you know, the crash or Pearl Harbor. Well, they're the only ones that have been through that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the children of the Great Depression and World War II, sometimes called the silent generation, who came of age during the American High. And I think in many ways this event and it's the sequel, the aftermath, has been has been tragic for this generation, because so much of what they had celebrated about recent trends in American life toward openness, globalism, individualism, sort of, you know, high tech, high touch complexity.
Good for business, easy life.
Exactly. Has been reversed. So many of these trends, we're seeing trends away from individualism toward community, closed might be better than open. It's in a huge decline in mobility. Just getting people to move around is getting to be a problem. And as for high tech, I mean, they brought down the World Trade Center with knives. I mean, just think about it. There's something almost mythic about this confrontation of civilization and something else going on here. With boomers, I think what we see most is a generation that's always been fixated on vision and values, taking a great deal of pride in their ability to describe good versus evil, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a values contest. This has to do with norms and who America really is, and they tell us what the war really means.
Does that mean they're rising to this conflict with a special gusto?
I think they are. I think we see it particularly in the media. One interesting thing that I've seen in the polls, and this is something we started noticing with Desert Storm, when a lot of sort of, you know, anti-war demonstrators suddenly thought we should go in there and pulverize Saddam Hussein. And we noticed it, too, with the Kosovo conflict. We notice very strongly now a 10, 15, sometimes even 20 percentage points, boomers in their 40s and 50s more likely to advocate armed intervention, even at the risk of war and casualties, in order to make sure that good prevails over evil.
And these were the flower children.
These were the flower children. Remember, these weren't always the nonviolent flower children. Then going down, we see Generation X. I would say of all generations today, Generation X is probably the most disoriented by 9-1-1 and what's happened.
Because?
Well, older generations can recall a time when Americans respected big institutions and we thought about ourselves as a nation that was going somewhere. And, you know, we thought of government as being very powerful and so forth, even boomers as children during the American high. Xers can't recall any of that. The whole lesson of their life, even from childhood, has been in sort of the triumphant individual and, you know, being free agents in the economy and sort of making up all their own rules as they go along. And suddenly they're in America, which is everyone's trying to find, relocate themselves as a member of a bigger community. And they find that, I think, unlike those of us who are older, they don't have that experience. They can't remember a time when we thought of ourselves like that. And unlike younger kids who in schools have been more protected and in some ways more regimented and been more taught that there are all kinds of rules they have to abide by.
These are the millennials in your
exactly. These are the millennials. And just my a couple of comments on these millennial teens and kids. In many ways, these kids are already inoculated to what's going on. They've had Columbine. They've had zero tolerance rules. They a lot of them wear backpacks that you can see through. They have lockers that any adult can open up. Mm-hmm. This whole business about going on into an airport with any sharp object, well, they've lived with those kinds of rules in their own schools for a long time.
So there's a generational rundown, but that's not the only perspective on the range of responses here. Todd Gitlin, what are you seeing as the most compelling threads emerging in how Americans are responding to September 11th?
Well, you can count me a skeptic on a number of these dimensions. I, first of all, think it's far, far too early to have a strong sense of how this is going to play out. First of all, we don't know whether we're in the aftermath of a shock or simply at the end of the first chapter of a continuing shock. Mm. I take seriously the declarations by Secretary Rumsfeld and Powell that we're in an early stage of a very long endeavor. And people have spoken about this in terms of years, and I don't think it's outlandish to speak of the duration in terms of decades. I think that we're not facing a war in any conventional sense, and we've been alerted by both Rumsfeld and Powell that this war will not be declared victorious until Americans feel safe. Now, that's quite an oddity in the history of warfare. Victory traditionally is defined as something that's achieved through a surrender or a conquest. If we define victory as a matter of the views of Americans, well, then this is something very iffy. Now, all this is to say that if we think we understand the sensibilities of Americans simply on the basis of the last month, I think we'll fall very far short. For example, those who now feel in shock because of a sense of vulnerability and security arrangements and so on may come in the course of the next few years to feel that it's time to recover and to return to normalcy. And the economy, which was already headed, if not over a cliff, at least down a slippery slope, will eventually come back, and they may breathe sighs of relief and feel that it's time to return to normal, only then to discover.
Todd Gitlin will pick it up in just a minute.
Chapter 2.
Todd Gitlin will pick it up in just a minute. We'll take a brief break. Listeners, what's the range of responses to September 11 around your kitchen table, at your workplace or school? Do you see a pattern by age or perspective? Do you feel in the mainstream or out on a limb? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is WBUR, Boston.
from Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. These moments of national crisis are now part of collective memory.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Stay tuned to WBUR.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
President Kennedy, according to the Associated Press, and Texas Governor John Connally were shot from ambush today in Dallas, Texas, and it is not known whether either Mr. Kennedy or
throttling up, three engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave.
Ronald Reagan addressing the nation after the Challenger disaster, and a collection of indelible moments in the nation's history. The question in the years to come will be, where were you when the World Trade Towers crumbled? The question this hour is, how are you responding to the events of September 11th? How is your age, your gender, race, income shaping your response? Or are we all as one? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. We're talking with historian Neil Howe and Todd Gitlin, a professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University. In the studio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, Todd Gitlin's making the point just before the break that the big gong that's been hit here is not necessarily finished being hit. There may be a lot more to define the new era we're in. There may be more terrorist attacks. There may be much more to come. So it may be indeed too early. And yet we start responding. We start seeing the events that are on the table in our own way as we go forward. And history does echo through there.
Yeah. And the way we frame events can sometimes play us false, especially generationally. I'm thinking of two cases, the lead into World War II and the Vietnam War. In the lead into World War II, the American memory of World War I was so irredeemably tragic. It was considered so so wasted and pointless an endeavor that it sort of disarmed a generation facing the threat of Hitler. The Kaiser was not Hitler. And yet the whole psyche of the country through anti-war books, Farewell to Arms and films and so on, and through congressional hearings. There were hearings in the 30s into the merchants of death, that is to say the weapons makers and capitalists of World War I, who were the only ones, many Americans thought, who made money out of that. Well, this sort of disarmed minds as the 30s were going on, it made it very difficult for people to make the transition to the events begun by December 7. Indeed, Franklin Roosevelt only sustained the draft the year before, 1940, by one vote, and that by a high-handed parliamentary maneuver on the part of the House Speaker, Sam Rayburn. So isolationism was really born of the experience of the earlier generation, and then a later generation of policymakers, the Vietnam policymakers, were held in thrall by the metaphors of World War II, by Munich, especially McGeorge Bundy, who was President Kennedy and President Johnson's national security advisor, said, "I remember forever the terrible spring of 1940 when Hitler marched into Paris." And that filter of, you know, you can't compromise with these people. They'll be in San Francisco if you don't stop them in Vietnam. That's been the lesson of the 30s. That was a tragic misprison of reality in the 1960s. And in a way, of course, this generation today are going to have their minds framed by the terrible autumn of 2001.
Our listeners want to join the conversation. Let's bring them in. We're talking about the range of responses to September 11 and what's come since. What's the range of responses around your kitchen table? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Phil is on the line. Welcome, Phil.
Hi, Tom.
First, I'd like to just quickly thank you for these special coverage shows you've been doing. They've been very, I think, insightful, thought-provoking, and certainly cathartic for me.
Thanks, Phil. We're trying.
From my perspective, let me qualify this by saying I'm 35, turning 36 next month, and I feel that I have been a person of a generation that has been the beneficiary of the famous, I guess, John Quincy Adams quote, that I've had the opportunity to not have to go to war, to not know mm-hmm. war personally, mm-hmm. to be able to study poetry and art. And I'm very saddened and disturbed by the fact that my children and that my, I guess personally I associate more with Gen X than I do with the generation that I'm, I guess, classified in technically. Mm-hmm. But it's very saddening to me to see that we are not going to have another generation or two or maybe three or maybe more, I fear, that are going to be wrapped up in knowing war and studying the martial sciences and not be able to progress to study literature and art and history and music.
Yeah, who can't relate to your sense of loss here, Phil? Thanks for your call. Todd Gitlin, I want to come to you on this. We embrace your skepticism about easy categorization, and yet there is a range of responses here. You begin to see it right there. There's sadness at the loss of that sense of ease. You look closely at culture. How do you see the country responding as we move forward?
Well, Tom, actually, I identified very much with your response to the caller, which is who doesn't feel this? Mm-hmm. I think everyone feels crushed mm-hmm. by the loss of invulnerability. You know,
something we share.
I think it cuts way across generations. I mean, I see it in my, you know, my 20-year-old stepson, and I see it in my 84-year-old mother. Mm-hmm. And everybody around, I think, feels this sense that, that we're unified, actually, across many categories of social experience by a sense of something being ripped down. Now, it will remain to be argued over exactly what was ripped down and what to do about it. I don't think there's an automatic consensus about that. You know, Jack Beatty was right to talk about the Vietnam illusion that what was happening was World War II all over again. But it should also be remembered that if we'd had this discussion in 1965 about the impact of the Vietnam War, it would have looked as though America was going to produce pretty much a uniform consensual response to this new challenge to American power. Well, because the war didn't play out that way, in fact, the war ended up tearing the country apart. I don't want to suggest that that experience is going to be repeated here either, but simply to say that, you know, I think everyone is reeling, and I think we should be very careful about coming to some sort of premature definition of what this experience means and what it's going to do to us. All we know is that we've suffered a wound.
Mm. But are you suggesting that because we've just now come out of a time when we celebrate diversity, that perhaps we'll be more unified going forward, that lockstep may be the new ethos?
For now, I think we feel uniform in having, number one, experienced a loss, and number two, experiencing a resolve to put an end to the threat that produced this loss. But how to do that, I think, is by no means clear. And if we are frustrated, as I suspect we will be, in actually delivering the culprits, then it's by no means clear how to proceed, and I wouldn't expect that there will be a consensus.
Listeners, what's the range of views around your kitchen table? Are you feeling all on the same board, or more diversity than that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Peter is on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Peter from Medford. Just a couple of comments. I guess my age group is 53 years old, so I'm of the Vietnam age group. I also happen to be a Vietnam veteran. First thing, I think that the incident that occurred clearly is a wake-up call for a particularly younger generation that just, I think, emphasizes the point there is no free lunch, and this is exactly what has happened. I think a lot of kids growing up in America have unrealistic expectations of what the world is about, and that unfortunately, through these events now, I think we have to respond militarily. I think Bush is probably doing as good a job as he possibly can under the circumstances. I think the point that I would like to make, though, is that I see with this 18 to like 35-year-old generation it seems like they've grown up pampered. A lot of I'm talking mostly the affluent kids that are in these wealthy suburbs, mm-hmm. grow up with parents that are affluent. since World War II, you have had people who had an attitude that if I work and pay taxes, that's what being an American is about.
Peter, we've got your point, and it's a good one. Let's put it to Neil Howe. Neil, Peter's saying this is a big wake-up call for 30 and under. You agree? And how are they likely to respond?
Yes, it's a wake-up call for people in the 20s and 30s, kind of broadly termed Generation X, people born in the 60s and 70s. We've predicted for a while that Generation X hitting midlife, which they're about to do. I think Doug Koopman turns age 40 this year.
The author.
Mm-hmm. Will slow down. This is a generation that's going to slow down and try to simplify life, try to create a few social anchors, and become intensely protective of family life, which I think a lot of Xers are already doing.
So how does crisis impact that?
I think this has caused them to gather those the wagons in a circle a lot more quickly, and basically is pushing something that was already beginning to happen in this generation. We had a lot of stories here, both in New York and D.C., on Xers who were very regretful that they hadn't gotten married or they hadn't made some big commitments in their lives sooner, and that this was a wake-up call for suddenly to think about getting their whole lives in order, to make choices, and to really have a life, as the expression goes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, just that I think we've all heard elements of that, people saying, gosh, it's time to pull up our socks and my socks. It's funny how the big national picture becomes very intimate and personal, doesn't it, Jack Beattie?
Yeah. I think people are sort of saying with that Belgian poet at the eve of World War I, with emotion to the man I used to be. I mean, people are feeling that they're changing. You know, these young people, they're not only facing this unprecedented vulnerability of their country. Never, not since the War of 1812, have we been attacked on our continental soil, and never like this. They're not only facing that. This is the generation of globalization. They're adrift in the global economy, which is a machine of creative destruction, insecurity. The New York Times, writing in 1996 in their series on downsizing, said that there was more economic insecurity in the mid-90s than at any other time since the Great Depression. So here you have a situation like World War II with insecurity, plus, for many people, economic insecurity that has just been eating away throughout the economy in the 90s. This is a tough fate for people to package.
Listeners, how's it striking you? How's it hitting your kitchen table conversation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric.
Good evening. My name is Eric Weltman. I work with a peace and justice organization here in Boston, CP PACS, and I'm very hesitant to generalize across generations, and much less very hesitant to suggest that the nation is speaking with one voice. Here in Boston, we've had peace vigils with thousands of people from all ages, students, old people, middle-aged people, all who are speaking out against the warmongering coming out from the Bush administration.
So you're contrasting that, Eric, with Washington or with some kind of mainstream?
I'm contrasting that with both what's coming out of the Bush administration as well as our congressional leaders who are suggesting the need for the nation to speak with one voice. And I think that the media is picking up on that, and as you did earlier in the program, stating that we are, when in fact there are many voices of all different age, color, ethnicity, and background who are saying that we shouldn't be going to war in the Middle East, and that we need to get the root causes of the hatred, the poverty, and despair that gives rise to terrorism. And I think that's a diversity of voices that is not necessarily being reflected in the media.
Eric, we're looking to open the microphones to that diversity here every night. Todd Gitlin, you wrote the book on this in the 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. As you alluded to earlier, and you wrote about at length there, the country turned very powerfully against that war. Eric is already pointing to the nascent peace movement here. Is the setup similar? Do you see a peace movement could emerge out of this as divisive as before?
I think everything depends on the course of this war, if war it is. The percentages who rally around the president's policy, whatever the president is, whether it's Roosevelt in 1941 or Johnson in 1965 or George Bush the Elder in 1991 or now, are basically the same, 85-90%. But then we wait and see what happens. This is obviously not going to be a weekend war or the sort of essentially
immune war that we fought in the Gulf or even more in Kosovo, if this is a long and unsuccessful war, a war like Vietnam, where Americans progressively saw more claims and little progress, then I think the debates open up. Right now, I think, you know, there are a disturbingly large number of people in America who think that the, as I heard somebody say on public radio in New York today, this is no time to try to understand what happened.
Let's see.
I don't think that sentiment will prevail.
Let's see what listeners have to say. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Lisa is on the line. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I called in because of what Todd Gitlin had said earlier about how it's premature to be drawing these conclusions about the way things break down. And I was just having a conversation with my husband where I said, you know, it just seems bizarre to be taking these polls so soon after September 11th. It's like asking someone who just witnessed their mother getting beat up if they wanted to strangle the guy with their bare hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, you know, and I don't fit into the category of my age group. I'm not having that kind of response myself. But
are you waving the flag then, Lisa, or you're not on board with that? Or
no, I'm not waving the flag, and I'm having real concerns and doubts about all the rhetoric that's been coming out of President Bush and his people. And I'm trying to look at the, you know, the root causes and the historical context and how we got into this.
Right.
And
we're trying that here too, Lisa, every night. Thanks for your call. Jack, Lisa's pointing to this, saying it's too early to say, but this element of patriotism comes up. Does that unify?
Well, that's been the historical pattern that there have been these rally around the flag effects helping presidents, but these have quickly slipped away. The cliche is, of course, politics stops at the water's edge. That's never been true. I mean, right from the War of 1812, when the New England Federalists practically seceded from the Union over the war, and it went through the Civil War and certainly right into World War II, there was politics and division even in that war. So it's hard to escape from the rhythms of American politics and American dissent, even in the most unified moment.
Listeners, as we all try to get our heads around this new situation, do you feel in the mainstream or out on a limb? Let us know. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Or join the conversation online at WBOR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. We're talking tonight with Neil Howe, author of Millennials Rising, The Next Great Generation, and Todd Gitlin, professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University. And as always, our own Jack Beatty here in the studio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the range of American responses to the new day that we're living in. How is terrorism on this soil and the new war changing America? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. With us tonight is historian Neil Howe, Professor Todd Gitlin from New York University, and our Special Coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Neil Howe, you've said that mentioned earlier this evening that the boomers are emerging as perhaps the most martial of generations. Why is that? They started out with the peace message.
Well, this is actually part of a rhythm of American history that many have noticed. Arnold Toynbee and Quincy Wright used to talk about the long war cycle in the West and in America in particular, how it was that it was the children born right after great eras of crisis in our history that much later in life, entering old age, always take America into and through the next great crisis. And they attributed that to the fact that it takes the generation who don't remember crisis, right, to be more willing to lead us back into it again. We think there's much more to it than that, and really all generations are kind of taking part in this sort of multi-role drama that's going on. But that it certainly is true that boomer-like generations have always had this capacity toward absolute, uncompromising solutions. Because when you're fixed on on questions of values and right and wrong with that sort of a spiritualist, inner-driven dimension that so many boomers bring to it, it's very hard to compromise. It's very hard to say, split the difference. One thing I did want to say in all this is that I totally agree with everyone's comment that we don't know, obviously, what the import of this event is going to be, whether it in a way defines the next 20 years or whether it's simply one of these horrible things that we sort of learn to absorb over time. One thing I did want to point out, though, is that if you look historically at some of the events which get us into these big crises, and obviously Pearl Harbor would be one, and the attack on Fort Sumter would be another, and the Boston Tea Party would be yet another, is that what happens is when you get into these eras is sometimes the public mood gets even more implacable and becomes even the goals become even more extreme and challenging
as the public begins to move into it. Pushing back
harder. Exactly. Mm-hmm. In World War II, it was unclear what our goals were at the very beginning, but by the end of it, it was unconditional surrender and occupation of Japan, and the same with Germany. We were not going to settle for less. As you recall in the Civil War, we did not have all of the amendments to the Constitution and the emancipation of the slaves as an initial goal of the war. That occurred halfway in the middle of the war when we became actually more extreme in our ambitions and our goals. And I think that the talk about root causes is a very interesting one, because I think the assumption is often that people interested in root causes are anti-war or pacifist. Mm-hmm. But if you look at some of the great wars and crusades, very violent ones in our history, they have been waged in order to precisely bring to bear some of these root cause solutions. I mean, after all, that's what MacArthur did in Japan. He instituted a whole new government, and he basically reconstructed the economy according to a new kind of political and social constitution. That's really going after the root causes. And people are occasionally wondering if the current kinds of problems we're having in the Islamic world, and particularly in the Middle East, might lead to those much more ambitious goals over time, all depending, of course, on events.
Listeners, how do you feel about it? Do you want to go after terrorism branch and root, or do you want to go to the root of the problem and be the new MacArthurs in the Middle East? It's a big challenge. How are you responding? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Lynn is on the line. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you. I have a two-part question for Neil Howe. Mr. Howe, this event prompted me once again to read your 1991 book, Generations, The History of America's Future. I think that's a must-read, by the way. It's been very important to me. This event comes very close to the same point in this generational cycle as you and Mr. Strauss theorized it in your book, as the outbreak of the American Civil War came in its cycle. So I have two questions. First, do you see a risk of idealist overreaction, such as occurred with the Civil War? And second, what lessons can we learn from history to counter this and lower the risk?
Thanks, Lynn. And Neil, how put that into perspective for us?
Well, that's an interesting question. And here we obviously have an informed reader. One of the things we pointed out, both in Generations and in The Fourth Turning, was that crises that start when this idealist, or what we call the prophet archetype generation, is still relatively young, tend to be more violent and often don't turn out as well. We often have hypothesized, and we don't have enough cases to say this with absolute certainty, that it's best for a generation like boomers to be older and a little bit out of power, and to have another generation like Xers, who are a little bit better at actually managing real-world events, to be in charge. This is to some extent hypothetical, but I do think that sometimes I look around at my own generation and how they're responding, and I do wonder a little bit what's going to happen if they are truly the ones with their hands on all the levers.
Todd Gitlin, so far in the thrall of the attack and the sense of crisis, Washington has had a pretty free rein in framing up this situation that we're in. But as we go forward, polls and the political sense of the nation will begin to become important. What do you think that the administration will be looking for to gauge public support for the direction they're set out on?
Well, they have a policy. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's...
We're waiting to see, aren't we?
Well, it seems to be headed toward Afghanistan, and it will include military action on the ground and on and from the sea and from the air. And there are many imponderables here. They may be able to deliver Osama bin Laden in rapid order. I think it's extremely unlikely, but it's possible. And then they can have a victory parade, and everybody will feel tremendous relief. And this may or may not actually look like a victory, a few months or a few years later. In that case, though, I think many people would breathe a huge sigh of relief, and George Bush would have a tremendous bounce from it. And although the parties in power generally lose seats in the congressional election immediately following a war,
but if it's not so easy, and you've said
it's not so easy, then we're going to, I think, have something like the sort of intense value collision that Neil has been talking about, I think rightly, with respect to the baby boom generation.
And what would the components of that collision be? Who with what?
I think there'll be some sense. I mean, again, the other big factor is, have we gone it alone, and what kind of coalition is held together, and how stable are our allies? I mean, these are somewhat different considerations than we ever had to face before. But I think there will be something of a clash between those people who think that what you do when you're stalled is escalate militarily, and those who think that you need to do something else. Now, it won't be altogether clear, and there won't be any uniformity about what that something else would be.
We've had callers who say, let's put the Marshall Plan first. We have another caller on the line right now. Paul, welcome. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I just wanted to make a couple of statements. One, I am a baby boomer, closer to 50 than I am to 49, and during the Vietnam War, though I respected everybody that fought there, I was against the war, and I protested out against it. But in light of the September 11th attacks, and it was a direct attack on our country, and there is really a feeling that it's changed my views 180%. But I think it's because of the feeling that we have to protect our own people and our own country. And this is an unseen enemy that's not only in other countries, but also within our own country, as was proven. And so although I'm backing the administration for what I see right now, I don't really want to see us indiscriminately bombing other countries and invading other countries, but I do believe that we have to bring terrorism and its agents to justice, and I think we have to do that by first securing our country and making sure that our people are safe.
We've got it, Paul, and thanks for your call. Todd Gitlin, there it is. It's up, defiant. It's ready to do what's necessary.
Well, but you see, I think 90-95% of the country agrees with the caller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I agree with the caller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who's not for self-defense, and who is for indiscriminate military action? He said both.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, the proof will be in the pudding, and maybe it'll be successful, the sort of action that the administration has in mind. I suspect it won't be. And then, you know, we'll have a very agonizing decision.
And I
don't think, you know, there is a lot of Yahoo talk these days. I'm not speaking of the caller. I mean, there's sort of, you know, Nukem, Stone Age sort of talk.
Right.
As the earlier caller said, you know, this is like the reaction, you know, somebody's just killed my mother. I want to strangle the son of a bitch.
We got it. Neil Howe, we've just got a few seconds. Final thought.
Yes, I think that what's really amazing is this young generation of millennials. Anyone who's talked to them about this event has seen how sober, serious, reflective they are, how much they avoid any talk of, you know, one day wonder wars and going in and nuking them. This is a generation with a steady eye on the future, planning way ahead. And I think it's a great generation of kids as they grow older to be handling a lot of this for us.
Mm. Jack Beattie?
Yeah, well, to pick up on something Neil said earlier, if in fact the boomers want unconditional surrender in this war, they're going to be sorely disappointed. I'm afraid the administration has set itself up for an expectation gap. The expectation, as Todd says, that Americans will be safe. How? When?
Yeah, that's the question. Todd Gitlin, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Neil Howe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Todd Gitlin is professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at NYU. Neil Howe is a historian and co-author of Millennials Rising, The Next Great Generation. Jack Beattie is our special coverage news analyst and a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people from around the country in the form of radio diaries. Hannah Peterson is from Sanford, North Carolina, near Fort Bragg. She reminds us that the U.S. troops readying for war aren't the only ones that need support. So do the loved ones they will leave behind.
Well, I feel that I may be directly affected by the terrorist attacks on September 11th because my fiancé is an enlisted soldier stationed at Fort Bragg. The military does not have the same viewpoint. The military does not offer support groups for what they would technically call a girlfriend. I am much more than a girlfriend. Fort Bragg prides itself on their quality soldiers. I feel like I'm a big part of that, but at Fort Bragg, I'm only his girlfriend. When you're in the military, you can't have a girlfriend. If you really want to be together, you have a wife or you have nobody. What am I to do? The solution, in my eyes, is for us to get married. But then when could we get married? There is no time. I recently transferred employment to an office in this area so that my fiancé and I could be together. I have no family here. Everyone I have other than him and our two-year-old son are 3,000 miles away in California. This one soldier is my entire life, the one that I have loved since the day I was born, the man that I have loved since before we even met, and now before we can even plan our marriage, he may have to leave me and we will be apart again. Sometimes I feel so selfish. I guess I should be used to being apart from him by now. I was used to it, but that was when he was at Fort Bragg and I was back home in California where my family was within 15 miles of me. It is just that when my life finally starts to fall into place, this happens. I should not even be thinking about myself after what has happened. Most people would say I'm a whiny baby, and I understand that. I understood what I would be in for when I moved out here, the possibility of deployment, but I guess I did not gauge how the thought of being alone would affect me. I didn't realize how much I depended on him, and prior to moving here, depended on my family, not for anything in particular, just support and adult conversation. Once I started to feel overwhelmed with my selfish, I feel alone feeling, I decided to go online and research support programs. My search led me to the Fort Bragg website, and I saw that there are special programs to help family members when tragedy strikes. However, in the military's eyes, we are not a family, so support is not available to me. I can actually understand that to a point. Some service members change girlfriends like they change their underwear, so it doesn't make sense for the military to recognize girlfriends. However, I don't see any monetary burden associated with opening support groups to soldiers designated significant other. In the past, we had once talked about us not ever getting married because we knew how we felt about each other, and it should not matter if we were married or not. In our hearts, we are married already. But to the military, I am just the floozy that their soldier is shacking up with. It makes me sad that when I need to turn to my fiancé for support, he is not there for me. But he is supporting the military. Can I then turn to the military for support? No, I have no one to turn to.
Hannah Peterson lives in Sanford, North Carolina. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing more radio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send us your submissions by email. The address is special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is